Jugcast, January 2026 edition, with Jessie Marin, Phoebe Ryder, Emily Walls, and Louisa Mason.
Hello, Happy New Year, and welcome to the Jugcast. I'm Emily, and with me in the studio is Louisa. This month, we are kicking off the new year with a special interview with science communicator and climate advocate, Dr. Simon Clark. He talks to Jessie and Louisa about why climate literacy is important and what a day in the life of a YouTuber is really like. In our job bite, Phoebe sits down with Dr. Vasu Shaw about her research in galactic magnetism and cosmic rays. But first, the news.
Transporter 15's rideshare launched. The UK, among other international payloads, has had success in launching several satellite missions aboard SpaceX's Transporter 15. The launch on the 28th of November saw the release of 150 satellites, including BAE's Azalea cluster. It's the first satellites fitted with AI on board to process the data. And Blue Sky Space's MOV satellite, which you're going to be hearing more about in the next episode. So among the many missions to launch was ESA's Hydro GNSS, with the task of scouting for water on Earth. The satellite will receive reflected L-band transmissions from other satellites, such as GPS, to determine properties such as soil moisture, freeze-thaw, and biomass above ground. This technique is called Global Navigation Satellite Systems, or GNSS, reflectometry, and it really relies on each satellite containing two antennas to determine the delay in signal, as well as accounting for Doppler shifts in relative motion. And this whole mission has the aim to understand a bit more about our water cycle, as well as useful applications for agriculture, and I suppose as well, flooding management. This suite of successful satellite missions comes at an exciting time for the UK space sector, with funding opportunities, increased collaboration with ESA, and a question of what private industries can really do for our country's sector development.
Giant cosmic highway found rotating, carrying galaxies along for the ride. Imagine a giant strand in the universe, not made of steel, but of galaxies, gas, and dark matter, slowly spinning through space, carrying entire galaxies along its orbit. An international team of researchers, led by the University of Oxford, have just discovered one of the largest rotating structures ever seen, a cosmic filament stretching across millions of light years, spinning like a cosmic carousel. Using data from the radio survey Mighty H1, carried out by the Meerkat Radio Telescope Array, the researchers identified 14 galaxies rich in atomic hydrogen, or H1. That lie in an extremely narrow, elongated chain, around 1.7 megaparsecs long and just 36 kiloparsecs wide, but that was just the core. Surrounding these hydrogen-rich galaxies is a much larger filamentary structure, traced by thousands of optically detected galaxies, spanning at least 15 megaparsecs in length. The key revelation? The spin axis of those galaxies are highly aligned with the overall filament direction, much more than cosmological simulations had predicted. Even more striking was that the team had found strong evidence that the galaxies are orbiting around the spine of the filament, suggesting that the filament itself is rotating, carrying galaxies along with it, making it among the largest known rotating structures in the universe. So, why exactly does this all matter? The universe at large scales is thought to resemble a cosmic web, with galaxies, gas, and dark matter threaded along filaments. Connected at nodes at intersections, theoretical frameworks have long predicted that the motions and spins of galaxies should be influenced by their filamentary environment. But this is perhaps the strongest observational evidence yet, that not only galaxies, but entire filaments carry angular momentum, influencing how galaxies spin and evolve. This could change how we understand galaxy formation and evolution. Instead of galaxies acquiring gas and spinning largely through mergers or local processes, large-scale cosmic filaments might play a far more active role, shaping the spin, growth, and orientation of galaxies from the outside in. This discovery opens the door to a new era of cosmic web astronomy, as radio telescopes like Meerkat scan more of the skies and next-generation instruments come online. We might uncover many more such rotating filaments. Each could reveal fresh insight into how galaxies gather gas, gain spin, and build structure, not as isolated islands, but as part of a vast rotating cosmic highway.
This month, myself and Jesse chat to Simon Clark about the life of a science communicator. We also discuss the importance of how to talk about science with the public and the challenges we need to overcome to tackle the climate crisis.
Hi, I'm Jesse, and joining me is Lisa.
Hello.
And today we're joined by Simon Clark. Welcome.
Hello, thank you for having me on.
Thank you so much for joining us today. And so why don't we begin by having you introduce yourself and tell us a bit about what you do.
Sure. So I am a full-time science communicator is the term I tend to use because most of what I do is YouTube. I do YouTube videos, but when you tell people you're a YouTuber, that has connotations. People think you're Mr. Beast or something. Whereas I do videos primarily about climate change and sort of different aspects of the climate crisis. But my background is in physics, specifically atmospheric physics. So I sort of dance around a bit, sometimes do things that are a bit more in the physics realm. Sometimes also do stuff more on the historical and the sort of social side of things, which informed a book that I wrote as well called Firmament, which is the book that I wish I could have said I read on my personal statement when I was going to study physics. And various other things like some podcasting and live streaming. The umbrella term is science communicator.
Awesome. And so I guess the first question is, what drew you to atmospheric physics? Was it a particular video or article that you read?
So when I went to study physics at undergrad, I went with this intention of doing something in fusion. Like that was kind of what I was interested in. And then I realized that quite rapidly that it was an engineering problem and therefore just not very interesting. And so I was kind of going through the undergrad course, and the way that it was structured at Oxford was you had quite a lot of modules in third year where you kind of really got like a tapas taster menu of modern physics. And one of the things that we did was Fluids, Flows and Complexity was the name of the module. And we did an introduction to fluid mechanics for the first time. And I remember doing a problem that was about a fluid between two sheets. And you had a boundary condition at the top and the bottom, and it was heat. And no, I don't think there was actually heat in the thing. I think that was something that I immediately went, oh, but you could also make this heated at the bottom. And then that would be a bit like the atmosphere. And then you could work out the distribution in the continuum of how the velocity profile. And I was just hooked. There's something about that that was very the opposite of an infinite plane with a point particle with no friction that you do endlessly up until that point in physics. It was real. It was kind of goopy and tangible. And that really appealed to me because I've always loved the natural world and being outside. I read a lot of books by people like Gerald Durrell when I was a kid, and it kind of fit into that very neatly. And it meant that I could then study the planet and especially ended up doing a lot of stuff in climate, which brought it all back to stuff that I was interested in when I was a kid. So it was a bit of a convoluted journey to get there. It was weird that it took mathematics to get me to a point where I was able to actually study the least easily modelable system.
Like at university, you're talking about complex kind of like fluid mechanics. And I think I did an atmospheric physics course and it was like, wow, I understand what a cloud is. And that was enough for me. But fluid mechanics, of course, that makes sense.
The Oxford physics course was very theoretical and it was very abstract. And so this was the first time that you did actually get that tangible sense. In my master's, we sort of specialized. I did theoretical and atmospheric physics in parallel. And it was those parts of like, oh, that's why the sky's blue.
Yeah.
Oh, that's what a cloud is. Like, you still get that sense of wonder. I never want to lose that sense of wonder. I wouldn't call myself a scientist now because I don't do analysis. I don't publish in journals. And so I kind of don't want to say that I don't want to lose that sense as a scientist. But just as a person, I never want to lose that sense of, oh, cool. Yeah. Right? Like, that's why you get into science in the first place.
Yeah, definitely. I suppose this links quite nicely to the next question about something tangible. Science communication is very tangible in comparison to an academic.
Yeah, the moment that you explain something to someone and you see the light go on in their eyes and when they get it, that's the tangible moment of science communication, which in person is amazing. I did a demo earlier this year in London to about 600 school kids or something like that, doing an explainer of the Coriolis effect using a spinning office chair and having weights in each hand, and you get a kid to go on it. You bring the weights in to demonstrate the conservation of angular momentum. And you heard in the hall these like 600 kids be like, oh, all at once. And that's the best.
That's very cool.
I can't imagine a better job than that. Sadly, you don't quite get it so often online. You normally just get kind of abusive comments. but you do get it on Discord and in live streaming, which is very nice.
And so What does a typical day look like for you now between research and content planning, video making? How do you balance all of that on a daily basis?
I'm working on it. It's very much a work in progress. So up until last year, I had basically no work-life balance, like a proper academic. And it was last year that I got a studio space for the first time. So I actually had like a space that I could go to and leave at the end of the day. So now I've got a small kid, so I'm waking up at like 6:30 and doing parenting until they go to nursery, and then getting to the studio at like 8:30, basically trying to do a full work day, and then getting back home to do the next shift of parenting. And in that time, it kind of varies day to day, but it's a mixture of doing some admin in terms of just keeping everything running, because I've got myself, I've got a full-time editor, full-time short-form producer, a part-time short-form editor. I'm taking on somebody who's a part-time researcher as well. So just being a manager, I don't know how people do it. So I'm learning how to do that. And then doing a mixture of writing and researching. I draw a distinction between the two because to me, researching is very much like, I know where I want to get to. I know that this is the goal, but I need the supplementary material to get to that point. For example, we're in the middle of doing production on a video that, if it's not out by the time this is out, I've done something very wrong, about trains, about how trains basically cause the climate crisis. And this interesting thread of like, right, we know what the blocks are. We know that it is, you know, trains basically caused global capitalism through the colonial system, and that is what created fossil fuel companies, and that is what created the climate crisis. But actually going in and doing the literature review on, right, what are some specific examples in, for example, India or in West Africa of where these practices took place so that you can put that in the script. And then you have your body of research, and then you sit down and you basically have that on one screen and you have the script on the other screen, and you start pulling stuff across and making it fit together. So that's a lot of my day. At the moment, I'm also doing a lot of short form content. I've got a grant recently to fund 6 months of regular short form content, especially about climate misinformation. And so I have a call with my producer most days where we talk through what the news has been and topics that are in production, talking through the scripts that have been written, and then filming those. It's amazing how quickly the day gets away from you. Like, and especially when it's a day where you get to focus just on one thing. I remember this in the PhD, actually, like the purity of being like, today is the day where I fix this problem. And you sit down with your code and that's it. And at the moment, I'm building a board for this trains video we're doing in miniature. So we've got a miniature railway set that we're building. And that's like a whole day sitting down. It's like, right, I'm sculpting these cliffs. And then I am like doing the resin pour on the river. That's all I need to do today, apart from all that other stuff. Because then the time that you get to just do that tends to get squished and squished. So it's a really varied job. I have a particularly varied job, I think, as a science communicator, because I do a lot of stuff in tangible form, like in miniatures. I've done quite a few videos in that niche and I like doing them, so I like to do more, and working with other people and trying to balance, also doing some stuff on contract work for other people like the Royal Meteorological Society. No 2 days are the same, but like the broad pattern is a lot of research, a lot of writing, and far more emails than I really want in my life.
I think no matter where you are, you can't escape email.
Hey, I'm trying to hire somebody to do that for me as well, man. Like, if I can afford, if it massively cuts into my wage, it will make my life better.
Can I ask very quickly, how long does it take for you to put a typical kind of video together?
I'd say our typical production time is between a week and 2 weeks from concept to actual release. It does vary. So we just released about 2 days ago a video about President Trump and the speech he gave at the United Nations General Assembly, which was, even by his own standards, quite unhinged. And I think that took about a day to pull together and write. And then I think the edit took like another day. So those ones tend to be very quick. When you're shooting from the hip, God bless you, President Trump. I mean, I don't say it often, but sometimes he's really good just to get a video out. Whereas, you know, the miniatures video, the longest production was probably actually one that we just released as well, which was on the links between the fossil fuel industry, misinformation and AI companies, which was about an hour long documentary, basically. And that took the best part of a month. The median is somewhere in the middle. It's, you know, I normally budget 2 videos a month and then maybe 3 if we're feeling ambitious.
Yeah.
Or when the AdSense rates are good. December, you get 3 videos.
And so it sounds like you have quite a large team working for you. So in the Jodcast, we've been, well, Louisa mainly has been building the team up from scratch after we stopped.
For COVID.
Yeah, after we stopped for COVID. And so we've kind of experienced firsthand what it's like to try and like manage and try and like balance everything out. So we just released an episode about the Simons Observatory where we have, I think, a total of 10 different clips.
Probably a little bit more, like something like 10 or 13 interviews.
You don't get trained for this though, right? You don't, as a PhD, you are just like, just sit in your corner and do your thing. And then like, if you do stay in academia, you're like, cool, you're now going to have to start managing people. And you're like, well, no one told me how to do this. Like, no one gave me any advice or instruction about how to manage. So, you know, for the longest time, it was me and my editor, Luke. That was just the two of us. And it's only been recently that we've started to expand. But it is a bit of a sort of virtuous cycle, right? Like, if you can afford to bring somebody on, then they actually free you up to be able to make more stuff, which means you can bring in more money, which means you can bring on more people, and it goes and goes. So I need to be careful that we don't just keep expanding and expanding, because I know YouTubers who have like teams of dozens of people, and I don't want that life. Like, I enjoy the meat and potatoes and getting my boots on the ground in the script and writing and researching and presenting it, and I never want to be too far from that and just having my life be email and meetings. Like, the guy who runs the agency that I'm with, full of YouTubers, his day is just meetings, as far as I can tell. I mean, I already miss being able to just sit down and do coding. Like, there were several projects when it was just me, or just me and Luke, where I would be able to code for a couple of days, you know, code up a simulation or a bit of analysis, and that was the best. Like, just getting your hands in the data and drawing something out. And, yeah, you know, basically doing analysis that would, if you were in academia, we'd go into a paper rather than going into a YouTube video. Yeah, I want to do more of that. I miss it.
Have you ever thought about kind of spending a bit more time doing research and analysis?
I think I would never want to go back full time, I don't think. But I think doing something part time would be very interesting. Though my area would not be atmospheric physics anymore, because I feel like I've been out of the game for a couple of years, and in that time the literature has definitely moved on. But also, my area of expertise is firmly in science communication now. Like, that's where I've got the most reps. I know that I am one of the people that gets this type of SciComm the best, you know, at least on YouTube. And so I would be tempted to maybe do something part-time in the science communication field and sort of publishing on that. It would kind of depend on what the specific project was, really. Like, I've got an association, I'm an honorary fellow at the University of Bristol, and they've got the Cabot Institute down there, which maybe something could happen with. And whenever I visit a university, I do always go like, oh, this is pretty cool.
Draws you back to the academic
world. Yeah, whenever I think I'm out, they keep drawing me back in. Like,
come back, we have coffee. You
know? There's something about being on a campus as well that just keeps you young, I feel like. I think it's also, especially being a parent now, like, that's just my reality. And then you go, you're like, oh, I remember what this was like on campus. I remember being young and stupid. Like, now I'm just old and stupid. It's not as fun.
Atmospheric physics is a really broad and really difficult subject matter. And on top of that, there's a fair amount of miscommunication or misinformation that's all strewed within. And so, how do you balance complexity of the topic? How do you decide how much to simplify or like translate the difficult concepts for your target audience?
Yeah, that's that. In a way, that's like the heart of SciComm. My approach is, and I used to do this very explicitly, now it's kind of implicit, is to write out learning objectives. Like, what explicitly do I want my audience to come away with? And there's a specific framework, it's called the AEIOU responses, which is, I've got to try and remember them all now. Awareness, enjoyment, interest, opinion forming, and understanding. And so writing down two or three sentences at the top of the page where you say awareness of or understanding of and a specific thing. And then you do a script structure that is in service of those learning objectives. And you put in as much information and as much context as is necessary to get your audience to those learning objectives, but no more. Anything extraneous needs to be trimmed away. Sometimes you can get away with a little appendix within the story that's like, oh, this thing is just kind of cool on its own, and I'm just a bit geeky about this, I want to talk about this. But generally speaking, it's as much as is necessary, but no more, which is really frustrating and difficult, especially to begin with as a scientist, because we're all about the details and the literature. I think there's a part of us that wants to go, yeah, but look, but I did the reading. Like, you know, I know, I get this. And that's an instinct you kind of have to shunt down a little bit when you're a neuroscience communicator. But that is the balance, and it's something that you only learn by doing. This is something that I always say to students when they're asking about SciComm, is like, you learn by doing reps. The hardest advice I was ever given was the first 100 videos you make will suck. And that's okay, because you don't get to make your first good video until you've made all the mistakes in those first 100. And every time you'll improve and iterate and iterate. And for me, I think the first video that really popped off was my 218th or 213th video. Like, and all the ones up until then, you know, like, you just learn and learn and learn. You get your reps in. And that one specifically was a vlog about being a PhD student that just kind of like exploded on Reddit. But there's no way that could have been my first video. It might have looked like overnight success to some people, but like, overnight success takes a really long time. And it's the same for video production as it is for how you approach SciComm and how you craft a story.
And so, talking about stories, have you ever had a time where a particular analogy or framing things within a particular story really helped with communicating the point that you were trying to make?
Ooh, that's a very good question. Because that's the thing with SciComm, is that by doing it, you change your own understanding of a topic. You. I think it was Feynman that said that you don't really understand something until you can teach it. And I'm trying to think of an example off the top of my head. Like, one example that is in very early production and isn't out, or again, should be out by the time this comes out, is doing a video on food disinformation. So there's a very well-known playbook that the big oil industry uses in order to create misinformation around climate and solutions to the climate crisis that they themselves inherited from the tobacco industry, and how they cast doubt on the link between smoking and lung cancer. But not many people seem to be aware that the food industry actually uses a lot of the same techniques when it comes to obscuring work about the environmental impact of especially meat and processed meat, the environmental and health impacts. And so a video that we're doing at the moment was basically about this. And the problem with talking about food specifically in a climate context is there's a lot of baggage that people have. Like, as soon as you see something about food, you're like, oh great, I'm going to be made to feel ashamed because I'm not vegan. I know that meat is bad. There's the culture war aspect of it. Like, people who don't eat meat are soy boys and all that kind of stuff. And it was when we realized there was an angle on this, which was the human angle of the food scientists, that some of the food scientists who published a report with The Lancet in 2019 received death threats from people online who'd been whipped up by influencers who had been coordinated by a PR firm that was paid by one of the big agricultural companies to do this. And as soon as we sort of framed it in that manner, with that human first, it was like splitting an apple open. And it suddenly made the whole story, you could see it in a different perspective, which, if I can communicate to the audience, should be very successful. As I say, this isn't out yet, but that was like my experience of sort of sifting through. And it's almost like when you, I don't know, when you're creating a story, especially on a topic like that, that's so charged and has baggage associated with it, it's almost like you've been given like a transparent object and you're shining a torch through it in different directions. And then in a certain direction, you'll see structure inside that just suddenly makes the whole object clear to you. And that's like, to me, that's one of the best parts of this job at the moment, that is like exploring that and trying to think of new ways that you can look at these subjects and different angles to get people interested in it. So it happens all the time. That's the example that's in my head at the moment.
Oh, that's so awesome.
Yeah, I think in science often, the human aspect of it, we ask, like, there's a human doing whatever science field.
Well, as scientists, we tend to just treat science as this thing in a vacuum. So I'm here in Manchester at the moment because I'm giving a talk this morning on the link between climate crisis and colonialism, and the fact that it is a continuation of colonial violence, has its roots, and atmospheric science as a whole has its roots in colonialism. It wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for the Columbian Exchange. It wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for the East India Company providing data that went into the first maps of the atmosphere. Like, we just tend to look at an old map of atmospheric physics and go, oh, okay, that's neat. You don't think about who did it, how they did it, who funded them to do it, all of these questions, in a way that in the humanities is exactly how they do things. You know, it's so interesting being in climate because there are people coming at it from all these different angles. There are some people like me who came from the physics background and have since expanded into the humanities aspect of it. And then there are people from the humanities that have to grapple with some of the quite complex physics of what's actually happening. And I just feel like within physics, maybe most specifically, we just strip out all of that context. In a way, you know, harkening back to what I just said about how you do SciComm, maybe because the subject matter is challenging and you just get rid of all the extraneous stuff, Maybe it's to do with the type of person who's interested in physics in the first place. I certainly found my undergrad courses the most interesting when they did include the context about, you know, what was Schrödinger doing, what was Heisenberg doing when they came up with the stuff in the 20s to do with quantum mechanics. That's not only is it interesting, but it provides you with a different level of understanding of the subject. Mm-hmm. And what I'm ultimately trying to do with climate videos is provide climate literacy. That's the phrase that I like to use, where it's not just understanding about something, it's that next step beyond that. It's the historical and social and political context around where these things are happening. And I think as scientists, we are desperately bad at doing that most of the time. And I'd love to see it included more in undergrad courses. That was the motivation behind writing the book, because I wanted to know how we knew what we knew about the atmosphere. And all this stuff is out there. I didn't really do very much original research at all. There were a couple of bits that I had to do some real digging for. Like, for example, when the mesosphere was discovered and how was something that happened with a US military test in the 40s. Nobody seemed to know the answer to elsewhere. But, you know, all this stuff is out there. It's just not in the scientific literature, or certainly not the normal science communication literature.
In astronomy, we also, I think, in particular, don't think about the consequences, or just the general, the more broad context that surrounds us. A lot of the time we think that, well, because we're looking at space, we're separated from everything that happens down here.
Yeah.
But like a really big thing that people are starting to talk more about is the impact, not only the societal impacts that astronomy has, but also, most importantly, the climate impact.
Mm.
Those satellites need to be launched by rockets. Sometimes we strip, pave parts of the desert to just make giant arrays.
Well, the largest part of it is the compute time. Right, there was a paper that came out in 2022 that was analyzing, I can't remember which institute it was, but it was like a whole year of the carbon emissions. And it was like a third of it was approximately, I think, was sort of services, right? Like it was the products that they were buying, the electricity for the center itself, and flights to conferences and things like that. And the majority of the remainder was just compute time. Mm-hmm. It was just crunching numbers. And I was saying this to somebody yesterday, because we went to Jodrell Bank yesterday to do a bit of filming, how I think the previous generation of astronomers probably actually were inherently a bit better at limiting their carbon footprint because they had to write really efficient code because of the hardware that they were dealing with. Whereas people now, like, you can just bung a Python script into a cloud in a compute server and you're like, cool, it's going to take a bit longer, but whatever. And, you know, that has a real carbon footprint associated with it.
I mean, I do magnetohydrodynamics simulations, and so all that I do is I just send jobs onto the Dirac high-performance computing facilities. And every six to 3 months, I get a nice little message telling me exactly how much CO2 I've contributed.
That's good, though. That's great that that's a regular reminder.
Personally, I think it's a bit difficult because you don't want to use unnecessary resources, but at the same time, you are also allocated a certain number of CPU hours. And if you don't use them all up, then after the next time that you need to request more CPU hours, well, you're less likely to get them. So then after you have this incentive sometimes at the end of a semester to just send jobs that are more like triple or quadruple checking something rather than that aren't necessarily strictly necessary. Just because you don't want to lose the allocation for the next...
See, that's a prime example of how, like, as individuals, we have choices that we can make in terms of limiting our impact, right? But the thing that really is going to make a difference is the systematic changes. Like, that is an example of a system that is not built with the environmental impact in mind. I can understand why the system has been built the way it has been built, but that's clearly not doing its job as intended if your intention is to limit your environmental impact. And that's exactly the same in the real world. You know, as if academia is not the real world. you know, it's exactly the same in so many other parts of the world that we interact with. Like, we can do our best as individuals, but at the end of the day, we've got to change how these systems that we are operating in work.
But I'm going back to the science book, back to what you were touching on there. What would you like to see happen in terms of climate change? What do you think would make the biggest impact on an individual scale or on a systematic scale?
On an individual scale, big question.
Big question.
On an individual scale, the number one things that you can do to have an impact are engage in systematic change. Mm-hmm. So vote in your national, and people tend to downplay the importance of local elections. Like, local and city elections and the policies that come from those governments are hugely important when it comes to, for example, transport emissions, but also harking back to the video we did about misinformation, about limiting the spread of misinformation. So the tobacco industry was very successfully tackled in its misinformation campaign by limiting their ability to advertise. And that was something that was passed in legislation at a national and subnational level. So individual cities banned smoking adverts. Regions banned it. Countries banned it. Sports banned it. And so by influencing the policies that are being implemented at various levels, that's the probably the, that is the number one thing that you can do. But in terms of sort of more practical things, here in the UK, definitely flying and, well, transport in general is one of the largest contributions. So flying that bit less, taking public transport where it's possible, and changing diet. So one of the reasons we're doing this video about food is because that is such an oversized impact on the environment, and specifically cutting out meat and dairy from your diet. You don't have to go cold turkey. Like, it doesn't have to be all or nothing. I am a vegan most of the time. I'm veggie the rest of the time. It's not, for me, such an ideological thing, but it's nice knowing that, you know, animals haven't suffered in order for me to eat. But it's primarily for the carbon impact. And I know it doesn't have to be perfect to limit that. So that's what you can do as an individual. Systematically, it does come down to those policy changes that I mentioned. I am fresh off of talking about it in a video, so I think limiting the ability of the fossil fuel industry to spread misinformation is a huge policy win in terms of, you know, following the model of the tobacco industry. And something that is particularly worrying is the ability of generative AI to amplify their misinformation. And so some kind of policy around there would be another. We've done videos about AI before, about how it is fundamentally just underregulated in the goal of growth. You know, you don't want to stifle innovation, my dude, is what people will say. But it's like, yeah, but don't want to get the planet to keep living. So, like, you know, having policies that mean that generative AI companies have to be transparent about the energy and water usage of their products. So this is very laser specific in terms of, like, you know, what things that I'd like to see changed. More broadly, I think moving away from the economic model that prioritizes growth at all costs. In fact, in the talk I'm going to give later on today, talking about the fact that railways expanded to colonies, partly because capitalists in the mid-19th century in England engaged in railway mania. They just plowed money into railways in the same way that people plowed money into canals a century previously, because they had these fabulous returns on investment. But that couldn't continue forever because it was a finite island. And so you had to start engaging in enterprises elsewhere, like, for example, India. The same applies to the whole planet. Like, you are not going to get, just as you can't expect infinite growth on a finite island, you can't expect infinite growth on a finite planet. It's the most short-term form of thinking. Mm-hmm. And so a move away from that towards a model that's variously described as donut economics, like economic prosperity within planetary boundaries, not just climate, but also biodiversity, soil health, ocean health, that kind of thing. That's how we get out of this problem, right? Like, it's good and right to use paper straws and to not use plastic bags and all that kind of thing, but you're not going to paper straw your way out of the climate crisis. The way you're going to do that is through systematic change. And the thing that fundamentally underlies the problem is the way that we think about growth and the way that we think about the economy. Now, I fully throw my hands up and say that I am not an economist. I'm not a political scientist. This is just somebody who has spent a lot of time on both the physical and the humanities side of this, and saying, this is what the problem is. How we fix this, I'm not certain. But I can tell you that this is where the fundamental problem is.
Talking about things that we don't necessarily fully grasp, you made a video talking about, I think if I remember well, 11 unsolved problems in climate science. Yeah. And so I was just wondering if you had one of those 11 unsolved problems that was particularly exciting or of interest to you.
The one that stuck in my mind was, what happens after net zero? There's an interesting hypothetical here, which is, like, a future exists where the IPCC reports are not about how much worse the situation is getting. Mm. It's a case of, this is how much progress we've made over the past 5 years. That future exists out there. And what do we do once we know that the amount of carbon in the atmosphere is stable or maybe slightly decreasing? We're not within probably 50 years of that, realistically. Which is kind of a crazy thing to say, by the way. Like, you think about the scale of the problem that we're in and the timeline that we're looking at is, you know, maybe 50 years, like 50 to 100 years of actually just getting us down to net zero. But what happens after that? What do policies look like? And what does a world look like in which you've displaced all fossil fuel electricity, but you still actually do have a environmental footprint of building your low carbon technologies? There's engineering problems to do there. There's problems to do with carbon removal from the atmosphere. What techniques do you use to do that? what speed do you do that? You know, how do you pay people to do that? It's not a crazy distance into the future. It's a problem that the three of us in this room are probably not going to have to get our hands dirty in solving, but someone will. And I just find the idea of that really interesting. And I know that there is interesting research to be done laying the foundations for that future that is necessary. If we want to keep the world to keep spinning and working the way that it currently does, like, that is a necessary future. So someone's got to start preparing for it.
That's a very, very interesting kind of puzzle.
Well, we just don't talk about it. Like, I remember there was a anthology of conversations around climate called What If We Get It Right? And I'd honestly never thought of that before. We spend all of this time thinking about this existential threat. Because if you don't spend all your time thinking about it, you're not taking it seriously enough, really. But yeah, like, just the thought of what happens if we do it right and we make a better world that is more equitable, that is more inclusive, that ends the cycle of colonial violence that started, you know, 300 or 400 years ago. Like, it's possible. And you can kind of get a sense of, every now and again, I get a flash of what that might look like, of what a truly global, fair, circular economy might look like. And every now and again, I need that just to keep me going.
It feels like a bit of just a little flash of optimism in what could be a very gloom and doom kind of outlook on
the
world.
It. Like, you absolutely need it. And because one of the big problems with climate communication is doomerism, this idea that there's just nothing we can do. There are people, I just can't quite believe this, but there are people online who are actively cheering for humanity's extinction and are like, I want to see the concentration go up as much as possible. I've had hate comments from people that are like, this guy's just trying to give people hope, like, there's nothing we can do, like, you know, the sooner we die, the better, all that kind of stuff. And it's like, the nature of the problem is a cumulative one. And as soon as you stop caring and you stop trying to make it better, it stops getting better. Mm. You need to have some hope. It's a little grandiose, but sometimes I think, like, I need to be the Samwise Gamgee in the climate story. Right, like, online. I need to be the person that's like, guys, a positive future, it does exist. It is absolutely possible. So many academics have published about this saying, we know that it can be done. We know what needs to be done. We just got to do it. I definitely get days where I'm very, very depressed about the state of, well, the trajectory of the world, especially when it comes to biodiversity loss. But you've got to just keep going, because as soon as you stop caring, that's when you guarantee the worst possible outcome will happen. And I've banned in my comment section the word hopium and copium, because it's just not helpful. And there's evidence that, you know, advocates for the fossil fuel industry who are pushing that kind of doomerist narrative because it delays action. You've just not got to give in to despair, because as astronomers, you know better than anyone that this is the one place that we have in the universe. There is no planet B, and as soon as you give up on it, that's it. You're toast, and everything else on this planet that we recognize is toast. And there is no alternative, so you've got to keep going.
I guess a key thing in getting us to keep going is teaching people about climate science and inspiring people to get into the field and to get thinking about science. And so that leads me to your book, So Firmament, The Hidden Science of Weather, Climate Change, and the Air That Surrounds Us. And so what inspired you to start writing this book?
So when I applied to do physics, I, like everybody, said on my personal statement that I'd read a couple of key books. I think I shouted out The Elegant Universe by Brian Greene, Brief History of Time. Like, there are a couple of key texts that everybody talks about. And I was rapidly reading some of them on the way to my interview at Oxford, because I hadn't read them. But one didn't exist for atmospheric physics. And so I wanted to write the book that future kids would say they've read and would frantically read on the way to their interview. And it wasn't specifically about weather and it wasn't about climate, but there was this gap, as far as I could tell, in the popular literature that was actually about the atmosphere and what it is, how tall is it, how does it work, how does it connect to those other fields, and how do we know what we know about it? So I just felt that there was this gap that needed to be filled, and I could see that I could do it. And if I was to do it again, I'd probably do it a little bit differently. I think I could write it better now, but I'm pretty happy with how it came out.
Awesome. And so our last question is, what advice do you have for young PhDs like us that might not necessarily want to go through the full academic route, but I still want to stay linked to science because it's what we love and it's our passion?
That was the situation that I was in, right? I knew that I didn't want to stay in academia. I started the PhD fully thinking that I would have a career as a professor eventually. but I kind of realized that it wasn't for me. And science communication has definitely been a really great way of staying connected to it. I'm very lucky in that that's just part of my job. But I can certainly say that in my field, there are so many resources out there that allow you to stay on top of the latest developments. You know, within climate specifically, you've got Carbon Brief daily and weekly briefings. You've got Nature's newsletters from basically every major publisher, to be honest. And then other things like Substacks like Hannah Ritchie's Substack or Bill McKibben's The Crucial Years. You know, there are so many resources out there that just let you check in regularly. I think that's the key thing. Is, you know, you're not going to stay in touch with the field once a year, right? It's a relationship like any other relationship. And if you're going to have a meaningful relationship with your field of study, keep regular touch with it, whether that's through newsletters or podcasts or videos or books or whatever it is. I mean, ideally, a healthy diet has lots of those things in it, including stuff that happens in person. But try to make it regular. Just try to make sure that you are flexing that part of your brain as often as you can. And you'll be amazed at how much your understanding evolves after you leave academia. Because my understanding of atmospheric science, not specifically dynamics, which was what my field was in, sorry, my thesis was in, but my understanding of the broader context and the developments in climate and mitigation specifically are incomparable now compared to what they were early in the PhD or late in the PhD. You know, your capacity for growth is bigger than you think, and it doesn't have to take place in an academic setting.
I like that. I like that. That's a very nice way to finish the interview. I think that's
it gets better.
It gets better.
Well, Simon, thank you so much for taking the time out of your very busy schedule to talk with us today.
Well, my pleasure. As I said before we started rolling, I did student radio at Exeter. So I this is a real throwback. Like, I love this. You've got higher production values than we had. We didn't have pop filters. We had a coat hanger with a pair of tights over them. So, you know, it's very nice in here.
We've greatly moved up since the days where we had to shoot, like, record under a blanket.
It's a necessary part of any podcaster's career.
In this month's Job Bite, Phoebe talks to JBCA's postdoc Vasu Shaw about her work on galactic magnetism, the future of cosmic ray experiments, and the environmental impact of astrophysics research.
So, hello. Joining me in the studio today is Dr. Vasu Shaw, a postdoctoral researcher here at JBCA. Your work here involves looking at galactic magnetism, considering magnetic fields are invisible to the eye. How do you do that?
Right, so there are multiple ways you can actually study galactic magnetic fields. One of them being, you know, just looking at radio data. So you can look at something called synchrotron radiation, which is when you have very high energetic particles, presumably electrons, and they gyrate or move along the magnetic fields in the galaxy, and their path is sort of helical, right? And then they emit a radiation called synchrotron radiation. This can be polarized or unpolarized, and it can be picked up by most of the radio observations that we have, low frequency ones. So when I say lower frequency, we're talking about few gigahertz to a few tens of gigahertz. So that's one way. Planck satellite mission was one way that you could have looked into synchrotron, both polarized and unpolarized, and WMAP, and there are many more. So basically what you do look when you look at polarized radiation, you can also not only deduce the strength, assuming something for the electrons. You don't have both information. So you don't know the field, and you also don't know how the electrons are distributed. That's the biggest problem, because you don't want the electrons distribution around Earth. You want the electron distribution in the galaxy, and nobody has gone there. So it's very hard. So you make some assumptions there, and you calculate the magnetic field out of that. And because you have polarization, you can also get the angles and things like that. You can look into dust polarization. That's not something I work into, but then you look into how the dust are aligned around magnetic fields, and that's one way. Another way is looking at ultra-high energy cosmic ray propagation. So when I say ultra-high energy, just to give you a reference, a cosmic ray that you are using for synchrotron radiation is about few tens of GeV to up to a couple of hundred GeV. So 1 GeV is 10 to the power 9 EV. Ultra-high energy cosmic rays go from 10 to the power 18 to 10 to the power 21. So these are like really high energy. and they are not produced within our galaxy. We are not tracking the ones produced in a galaxy. The reason just being they are so energetic that the Larmor radius, so the radius at which they gyrate around the field, is super large. So it's larger than the galaxy sometimes, depending. Or it could be like comparable to the, it's like 5 or 6 kiloparsecs, which means most likely you don't see them from the galaxy. You're seeing extragalactic. So what you're doing when you look at Ultra-Hangi cosmic ray propagation is that if you know a source, there's a big caveat there, I'm going to get to that. If you know a source and you just assume that the distance between the galaxy and the source is kind of empty, so the magnetic fields is very weak. So you just assume sometimes they are not there, which is not true. And that's not the caveat. I'm going to get to that. So the cosmic ray is emitted from the source. It comes into the galaxy and then it starts dancing around the fields. And at some point, it might hit Earth and you observe that. Now, if you knew the source, you could have fit in some models of magnetic field just to see how the particle is being dragged. And if you knew the sort of field, which doesn't happen, then you could have tracked back to the source if you didn't know the source. In this case, we don't know anything, right? We don't know the source because the direction from which you see the particle coming is not its actual direction. Its direction has been changed within the field, and you don't know to what degree it has been changed. So this can be resolved if you have very good instruments which can actually separate the species of your cosmic ray. So proton, iron, other things. So the heavier your particle, different particles will deflect at different energies, will deflect differently. So sometimes for our galaxy, the particle might not even deflect. Why? Because its Larmor radius is so large that it doesn't just see the galaxy. It just goes through straight. So this is what is going to happen. There is an upgrade of an experiment called Auger. So it's going to turn into Auger Prime. And in a decade's time, so when you all are established academics, hopefully, you might be able to study that. Because then we'll be able to separate cosmic rays species by species. And that might be one way to actually probe magnetic fields.
Wow, that's amazing. So when you say source, what do you mean by source?
So a source would be like an active galactic nuclei, okay. Some kind of starburst galaxy. We really don't know. We assume some. So if you've heard about Centaurus A,
yeah,
it is assumed to be one of the sources of ultra-hangi cosmic rays, just based on the data that we have and that it's relatively close to us. So the logic is if you're closer to us, you will have more particles coming in. It's like a very basic logic. There's nothing very fancy in that. And the further out it is, the fewer chances of the particles to get to us. Because there is deflection between the distance from the galaxy and the source. We tend to simplify the problem and forget about it in some situations, like when I'm working on.
Going back to the synchrotron emission that you mentioned first, what kind of instruments do you use to look at that?
So you can use something like, as I said, Planck satellite, or WMAP satellite was one at JBCA. We have an experiment called CBAS. We are basically working on CBAS North. So this covers the Northern Hemisphere. So it's a single dish survey at approximately 5 gigahertz. So it's scanning the sky. And it's, again, as I said, it's a radio frequency. So that is something we are using. I'm using here to what I'm doing is I'm using CBAS and I'm using another single dish survey, which is in the Southern Hemisphere called ESPAS, which is at about 2.3 gigahertz. And for such close frequencies, you can do some sort of data manipulation in the sense you just assume a spectral index and you extrapolate the lower frequency one to the higher one. And then you can create a map. And what you can do is you can do whatever kind of studies you want. So I'm comparing different galactic magnetic field models with this data. So just calculating synchrotron emission and seeing which one fits better.
Am I right in thinking that you're working with models and observations for the synchrotron emission? For the cosmic rays, are you doing simulations?
You can do simulations. I am not doing it right now.
Okay.
So we are assuming a very simple analytical expression for the cosmic ray distribution. Again, these are the low energy, few tens of GeV or 10 to the power 9 EV kind of cosmic rays. So we're just assuming an exponential distribution. Is it correct? No. But do we know the reality? No. So what's your approach? Rather than overcomplicating the problem, you just take something simple and take something complicated, in this case, the magnetic field, and try to understand what it means from the data. The idea is not to find an answer. You cannot know the structure of galactic magnetic fields. I'll say something very controversial in our lifetimes, okay? It's just a difficult problem. It's just difficult. So the idea is to understand mostly the simple physics behind it, which probably sometimes we overlook. So you need to appreciate problem more at the ground level rather than thinking, oh, we will solve the problem of galactic magnetic fields in the next 20 years. If somebody is saying that, they are wrong. They are just not being honest in the field. I am relatively young in the field. I know that. We can make good progress in having more understanding in the next 20 years, for sure. But we'll not know the structure. We're talking about a galaxy, which is about 30 kiloparsecs in disk and can go up to hundreds of kiloparsecs in circumgalactic medium. So, yeah, it's a difficult problem.
What would knowing the galactic magnetic field structure do? Why do we want to know it?
So there are a couple of reasons. A, magnetic fields are sort of everywhere, right? In the flow of gas in interstellar medium is because of magnetic fields. You have magnetic fields just involved in maintaining the pressures within the galaxy. So if you want to understand how a galaxy works, you want to know the magnetic field, because that's like one of the most fundamental things that exist in the galaxy. Just because where there are particles, there's a field. For me, from a cosmic ray side, I want to understand the sources of cosmic rays. So as I mentioned about Auger Prime, once Auger Prime really, it needs statistics over the next decade, right? So it needs a lot of data. Once it has that data, and we are able to maybe get some sense in the next, say, 20 years, okay, I think we can say with, certain certainty that these cosmic rays are coming from this source. Then we can start understanding the dynamics and the physics behind the source. Okay, what mechanisms might be leading for this source to produce this kind of cosmic ray? So that is one way to understand. So these are there are multiple things. Like magnetic fields are everywhere, right? It's there on Earth as well. So you have to understand that if you unravel a problem at the galactic level, or even the solar magnetic fields we don't understand properly, the physics is the same. It's just being applied at different scales. So it's mostly to understand the basic physics.
Well, it sounds like there's a lot to look forward to here, and the future looks exciting. So apart from your actual research, you've worked in many different institutions in many different countries, India, France, Germany, and now here in the UK. Have you experienced difference in the way scientific research is approached and carried out, or is astrophysics research sort of a universal language?
This will be a very subjective opinion, right?
Yeah.
Yes and no. So there is, in some ways, good academics, like somebody who's doing really research honestly, will do it the same way, irrespective of where they were born. Whether you were born in India, whether you were born in US, whether you were born in Kenya, whether you were born in France, doesn't matter. Because your curiosity drives this and you just want to know how things work, okay? Culturally, yes, there's a multitude of difference within academics. I'm not talking about the cultural difference between the countries. I'm talking about every time you interact with an academic who's not from your culture, you will see the way they think is also very tied to the way, sometimes tied to the way they come from. And that's something beautiful. That's the way you learn things from different cultures. So one weird habit I always had, wherever I live, I tend to pick up the mannerisms of that place very easily. I'm not doing that intentionally. It just happens. So when I lived in France, I would think in differently. When I lived in Germany, I was more analytical and logical. When I'm in the UK, I'm thinking differently. So yeah, there is a difference. It also depends on perception. Some people perceive these differences, some people don't. So yeah, there is difference. The institutions can have different working cultures as well. There's definitely different working cultures in different institutions. There, some places have a lot of hierarchy, so that's definitely in India where there's a lot of hierarchy. I feel definitely can stunt people in opening up. But just to say, the academics might, in the core value, can be very similar, but where they come from will definitely affect the way they think.
Also, alongside your astrophysics, you're passionate about reducing the environmental impact of research. What aspects of our research have the most impact on the environment?
So Astronomy, sadly, has one of the highest impacts in natural sciences on the climate. And the reason I looked into it is because towards the end of my PhD, I was curious to look into what was just my carbon footprint from my simulations. I took up about 25% of the institute's resources single-handedly. And my carbon footprint from all the research I had done was between 60 to 80 transatlantic flights. That's my carbon footprint. I will not take entire accountability for this because I was never encouraged to do efficient programming. I was never encouraged. And this is, by the way, just the computational carbon footprint. I have not counted my travels to conferences and etc. So I think as astronomers and astrophysicists, we really have the advantage to understand that we really have a single planet. Apart from climate scientists, we are in a very exclusive position of knowing that we cannot mess this up. And the problem with us as academics is we tend to be very analytical and we tend to like to have the information, and we have the information, but we tend to ignore it because it comes in between of our paper publication and next grant. So this is why I'm involved with some organization called Astronomers for Planet Earth. This is a non-governmental organization, and we are a few thousand people, from teachers to academics to students to whatnot. And basically our tiny mission is to make astronomy more sustainable whilst basically giving people more awareness about the climate catastrophe. So it will be very nice each time you decide as an academic, and I'm saying everyone, is like, oh, I want to go to like these four conferences this year. Maybe think like, okay, do I need to travel to all? You can also do something remotely, or maybe take the train. Maybe just have a little thought. The burden should not entirely fall on one individual. It should be your own choice. But just a little thought that, oh, can I go to this conference where I don't have to fly rather than this, where and I'll still see the same people? That's one option. And it just has to be done ever so often, bit by bit.
So apart from conferences, are there any other steps that, especially as young researchers, we can do to make the most impact? Or least impact, really.
One thing is when you start your PhD, when during your PhD, encourage your supervisors to provide you training in efficient programming. Try to make them understand that if you spend some time now on, I don't know, instead of writing 10 for loops like I used to do, just vectorizing your array, you've sped up the code, right? That's something, and that's going to be useful for you anyways for your career. Learning out how to basically store data efficiently, following open data policies. It's a very interlinked problem. It's interesting. If you can practice proper open science, you will also end up practicing better coding practices, which will lead for you to have lower impact in the long run.
What do you mean by open science?
So open science is basically saying that making your codes public on GitHub, doing version control, making data public, accessible, things like that. Another thing that you can definitely request from your bosses is, for example, the institution that you're working at, they can provide you with certain facilities that can help you to reduce your impact. So like if you have to come from home to work, one way the institute can incentivize you to coming to work efficiently is using public transportation. But public transportation can be expensive for students. So request your institutes to provide subsidy. This happens in a lot of institutes in Europe. So there is no reason that can be not implemented here. Also just providing students affordable meals and things like that. There's a lot of small things. Student welfare, again, this is off tangent, but climate activism and social activism are really going hand in hand. So if you can improve the life of people, you will do benefit also to the climate. So they are not mutually exclusive. In fact, they really go hand in hand.
Thank you so much, Vasu, for spending the time to be here and talking to us about your research and the climate activism as well.
Thank you so much.
This month, we don't have any listeners' feedback, but hopefully you all want to get in touch in the new year. And you can do so via Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or Blue Skies, or of course, send us a post. The links and details can be found on our website at www.jodcast.net.
Thank you so much to Simon Clark and Vasu Shaw for the interviews. The audio editors were Jamie Inslee, Fia Huxwell, and Josh Bishop. The show editor was Louisa Mason, and the producer was Phoebe Ryder. Until next time,
Jod on.